So this morning is the second in a seven-week look that we are arcing on over the summer. We're looking at some of the phrases that we find in the New Testament. We began last week with looking at Jesus' call, Jesus' command to us to love one another. This morning we're going to be looking at teaching and admonishing one another, and then so on, serving, living in harmony, bearing with, encouraging, being kind and forgiving one another. All of these phrases taken from different parts of the New Testament, where much of the focus is about how we live as followers of the one who has called us by name and has died so that we might find life in all its fullness. How do we follow Jesus? How do we become people of the way? How do we live as his disciples? How do we become beacons of light and hope? As how do we share what Jesus has done in our lives? That's the challenge. And invariably, in the New Testament, the answer to those questions has something to do with being in community. The Christian faith is inherently a communal one. Jesus invites us to be part of a family, to join the movement, to think about not just what we do and don't get out of anything, but also what we can contribute and how we can help others. And so littered throughout the New Testament are these little one another's, and we're spending this summer looking at them. Now this morning we're mainly in the book of Colossians, and the third chapter of Colossians is in fact the only bit of the Bible that we're looking at twice in our seven-week series. And in 3 weeks' time, Anne is going to be sharing with us about what it means to bear with one another. But this morning we're looking at the verses that follow, where we're encouraged to seek peace and to be thankful, and to let the message of Christ dwell richly among us as we teach and admonish one another. Or to put it another way, let the peace that comes from Christ rule in your hearts, for as members of one body you are called to live in peace and always be thankful. Let the message about Christ in all its richness fill your lives. Teach and counsel each other with all the wisdom he gives. Or to put it another way, let the peace of Christ keep you in tune with each other, in step with each other. None of this going off and doing your own thing. Cultivate thankfulness. And let the word of Christ, the message, have the run of the house. Give it plenty of room in your lives and instruct and direct one another using good common sense. The very first thing we do, whichever translation we're reading it in, is to keep in tune and to keep in step with one another, not going off and doing our own thing. Community is highly prized here, as it is throughout the Bible. The local church is a visible expression of the universal church. And there are plenty of challenges to making this work. It's why Paul, who is writing these words to the Colossian church, is asking them to let the peace of Christ help them, because we won't be able to do it without the help of Jesus. And it's difficult because there will always be people we find difficult. There will always be situations that we find confusing. And not everything that happens will be exactly as we would like it to be. But those are challenges to any group of people at any moment in history. There's nothing unique about a church gathered today about that. They're obvious to the extent that they should be fairly surmountable if we want them to be. If we join any group, any workforce, any church, any family, without expecting there to be at least one difficult relative or colleague, we are deluding ourselves. And if this morning you can't think of any, it could just be that everybody else is thinking of you. But I think there are... I know, that'll fester, I know. But I think there are perhaps two further challenges for us as followers of Jesus at this particular moment in history. The first we have discussed before, and it's this pervading individualism which makes everything in our life all about what suits me. Does everything fit in and around me? Is it at the time that I need? Is it exactly as I want it? And communities of any ilk can't survive if everybody takes that attitude. And Christian communities are called throughout the New Testament to be the antithesis, to be the total opposite of this. We thrive instead when others volunteer to help someone else in their own time, to use their resources for the good of others. When we ask what we can do, how we can help before we ask, what do I get out of it? But the second, and perhaps most difficult at this moment in history, is the challenge to each of us, which comes consistently through the example we see in the life of Jesus and then in the letters to the churches of the New Testament, is to grow in us a willingness to genuinely listen to others, to stay in the room when we don't all agree. Jürgen Moltmann, one of the great theologians of the past century, said that the Christian community, which should be a liberating community, no longer means just sitting down beside people I agree with. It means sitting beside the people I don't agree with and staying there. That's how he defines the difference between a non-Christian community and a Christian community. And that requires grace, and it requires a genuine openness to learning through and from each other. But it's the only way we can develop the depths of relationships that we're called to work for. If we're not prepared to genuinely listen to one another, we will never achieve the love and the grace and the hope that we're called to work for. If we look beyond the church around us in these days, it's easy to see how this is getting harder. We need look no further than our political life, where things seem ever divided. I've not drifted onto any of this in the last 2 years, so forgive me a couple of minutes. Politics doesn't seem to be so much at the moment about moral difference or policy divergence, but according to who you speak to, the failure of the other half of the country to know what's good for them. There is too often an unrepentant, condescending sneeriness towards people who voted for Brexit, for example, and a brash, belligerent defensiveness towards those who didn't. It isn't so much that it's this idea that people who think differently from us clearly aren't quite as clever as us, that they don't quite know what's good for them. You'll see it all over discussions, and it's why it's so hard to hear two people having a decent conversation about any of the issues. It never gets that far. Giles Fraser, an Anglican canon in East London, wrote this week, this is where smugness comes from. The idea that I know everything, you do not. It's not that we disagree ideologically because ideology is dead. All that's left is facts and knowing facts, and either you know what I know or you don't. And I know more than you do. And that doesn't get us anywhere. Instead, what we find is members of parliament getting death threats, a total lack of engaged conversation, and everything becomes ever more bewildering. And as followers of Jesus, whether we're in church or indeed we're engaging in a political discourse or at work or wherever it is we find ourselves, we are called to reach for something more, to create a liberating community, which means no longer just sitting down beside the people I agree with, and instead where we seek to sit beside the people we don't agree with, and to stay there. This sort of commitment to each other, this persevering dependability, is the bedrock of any thriving community. You can't get much further with anything if you're on eggshells wondering about who you're like next and whether they're going to leave the group. You can only build with the people committed and in for the long haul and hope that others will course. One of the other challenges to what Paul talks about here about teaching one another, most of us don't want to be taught or helped or corrected. We're told we've had our fill of experts, and we usually only want to hear from people who think the same sort of things that we do. But if we're going to make any faith to develop a maturity that enables us to faithfully serve others, then we'll need to be open to learning and growing. And sometimes that may mean listening to people who don't think about things the same way that we do. And Paul's clear, this isn't a job that he says is just for pastors or for elders or for our Bible study leaders or even our small group leaders. We all have a part to play in helping each other. If we believe, as I do, that we're all made in the image of God and that God can speak through any of us, then that should make us anxious to listen to everyone. Because then we might be able to learn something from them that we won't get. If I lack the capacity to listen to you, not just hear what you say, but listen to what you're saying. And if we can all get to a place where we recognize this need for growing in our faith and teaching, what exactly is it that we're going to be taught? Well, Colossians tells us that we're to let the word of Christ have the run of the house, and we are to seek wisdom. With God's help, we work on issues, we listen, we share, and wisdom rises as we let the Spirit guide us. As we work together to build a community that's increasingly servant-like and other-orientated and thoughtful and humble and thankful and caring, moving towards others rather than away from them, committed to the hard work and the sweet rewards of loving other people in the church. If we can do that, we're told that wisdom might appear too. Becoming a wise, insightful, discerning people happens as Christ forms a certain kind of spirit. There's this atmosphere, this dynamic, this culture amongst us. Wisdom is more often than not something that, yes, we'll come to in prayer and maybe in quietness, but as part of a rhythm of life that involves other people. Finding wisdom is not just about me and God and a prayer. It involves seeking others too. In another part of the New Testament, in the book of James, we read, "Do you want to be counted wise? To build a reputation for wisdom, here's what you need to do. To live well, to live wisely, live humbly. It's the way that you live, not the way that you talk, that counts. Mean-spirited ambition isn't wisdom. Boasting that you are wise isn't wisdom. Twisting the truth to make yourself sound wise isn't wisdom. That is the furthest thing from it." Instead, we're told that wisdom is marked by humility and a freedom from selfish ambition and jealousy, freedom from the need to boast and exaggerate. In other words, wisdom rises in relationships of love and humility and service. Wisdom is a communal gift. It is a corporate gift. Wisdom is given and found and forged in the fires of a community of committed relationships. And so where do we start? That's all very well and good, but what do we do? It isn't easy to know. But I think the answer is tucked away at the end of verse 15 of our reading, where we're simply told, be thankful. We're to cultivate thankfulness. If we want wisdom, if we want to know how to help each other, we begin with gratitude. I'm not sure I've ever quoted A.A. Milne in a sermon before. But this week, I was so very pleased to read this, so I thought I'd share it with you. Piglet noticed that even though he had a very small heart, it could hold rather a lot of gratitude. And I loved reading that this week. Gratitude, see, drives out resentment. It drives out anger. It drives out envy. Gratitude instead breeds joy and hope and adventure and wisdom. And how we do that, how we make gratitude an ever-increasing part of our life, well, there are lots of different ways we can do it. I have friends that have gratitude journals. They write down things every day they're grateful for. Or people who collect things they appreciate in a jar, and then at certain points in the year you can look at them. There are many of us here who make a point of trying to send thank you cards. I was reading this week about a lady in her 90s who has prayed specific prayers of thanksgiving at the same time every day for decades. It's 3 o'clock. I'm going to offer this prayer of thanksgiving for this person. And she spoke about how that had totally overwhelmed and changed her outlook on life. This regular commitment, this capacity to find a way, whatever it is that works for you, of weaving gratitude into your life will make it better. Because when we're grateful, we're not fearful. And when we're not fearful, we're not violent, we're not angry. If we're grateful, we act out of a sense of enough, not out of a sense of scarcity. When we're grateful, we're willing to share. If we're grateful, we'll enjoy the differences between people. We're able to be respectful to everybody. We're willing to learn. We live with open hearts and open minds, understanding that we don't know everything yet. And gratitude is where all of this starts. In James chapter 1, we read that every generous act of giving with every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the heavenly lights that do not change. And this is not a picture that James gives us of a God who targets gifts, but every gift, every good thing in this world, in your life, is a reflection of the goodness of God. In Matthew chapter 5, we're told that the sun rises and the rain falls on the righteous and on the unrighteous. Jesus, again, painting a picture of God as one who is wildly untargeting. As we see throughout the Gospels, Jesus wants to bless everyone. And so we see him tell stories of God as the one who lavishes inebriated wedding guests with even more and finer wine. God's the one who sows seeds with abandon, who issues invitations to the unnamed poor, who throws a party for the wayward children, who multiplies fish and bread so that thousands might eat. Blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are those who are hungry. Standing on a hill talking to the people, Jesus announces gifts for everyone. They are not targeted. There is nothing to pay back. They are simply gifts from God. And of course, in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, we see most clearly a gift from God for each of us. A gift that offers anyone who will accept it, anyone who will consider it, hope. The death and resurrection of Jesus offers hope for all people, offers hope for all of creation itself. The author of James goes on to say that we can understand in our heart that gifts and gratitude are part of the very fabric of the universe. And if we can do that, we'll be better people and we'll do more good in the world. He says, this is all in grace. So what does a community that understands this generous heart of God look like? Well, they help each other to come to an even better knowledge of this kind of God. They teach one another. And when they've done that, when we've shared, when we've listened, when we've walked together, we cannot help but sing our psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in our hearts. We sing because we're grateful for God's grace towards us. We sing because we are indeed blessed. And so, as the reading finishes, we do everything in the name of our Lord Jesus, giving thanks, trusting that by his Spirit and through one another, we will learn more and more about what it means to be one of his disciples and how we might walk the road together. We can only be the people God is calling us to be if we're willing to genuinely listen to one another. We can only be the people God is calling us to be if we're willing to engage in genuine conversation. We can only be a beacon of hope and light in a community and a nation that is ever fragmented and aggressive, if we're willing to let the peace of Christ rule in our hearts. So friends, may it be so for you and for me. Let us pray. Amen.